So, okay, let me change the subject. Indirectly, I still want to stay on discipleship, if I may. And I think I may. I got too much stuff open here. We will take a break, by the way, in about 15, 20 minutes. So if you can bear with me just a bit, that will help you to schedule your body. You know, I told you a story. My wife is one of those people who is always affirming. Just, she came from a home where, in fact, I could tell you a story about that too. In my family, we had four boys. And if I meet my brothers and they don't say three insulting things about me in the first 2.5 minutes, I wonder why they don't love me anymore. You know, some of you can relate to that. It's just constant harassment. And that's what I grew up with. It's, you say something, I think of a sarcastic comeback, that's, everybody laughs at. And that's how we lived. My wife, they were not allowed, they had 8 kids, they were not allowed to say anything negative about anybody, even their worst enemy. Their parents were dedicated Christians, mine were too, but they were, anyway, I met my wife about a month later. I asked her on the first date to a Tiger baseball game. So I picked her up on a Saturday morning. I was 17, she was 18, to go to this Tiger baseball game. So they were all sitting around the breakfast table, and I got introduced to all 7 of the other kids, to mom and dad. You know how that was, at least in my generation, when you meet your date's parents the first time. It was a little. So I'm sitting there meeting all these people. Her sister comes in the room. Now, her sister is a Miss America type, in a good sense. Beautiful to this day, a beautiful woman. She, valedictorian of her class, homecoming queen, class president, student council president, cheerleader, you name all that stuff, she was. And very humble about it. So she comes dancing, she's a year older than Esther. She comes dancing into the room, and she says, guess what? I lost 10 pounds. Now, in my family, this is batting practice. I mean, nobody told me that there were families that didn't do this kind of stuff. So my response was, turn around, I think I found it. I mean, doesn't that sound like a good comeback to... She started to cry. To this day, she's real nervous around me. Okay. If you asked me, what is the heart? You know what? I'm looking at my watch. It's a little bit early. We're going to go till about 4, and then I'll take a break at 4. And if people want to hang around, I'll answer some questions a little bit later. I'd love to do that. Let's take a 10-minute break, because this is a good break spot, and then we'll come back and finish it out with an intense study for the rest of the afternoon. Let's take a 10-minute break. There are 7 women who are said to sit at Jesus' feet. And that's the phrase, if you went to Israel and you met somebody who was in a rabbi's chavura, and you said, and you asked him about it, he wouldn't say, I'm in the rabbi's disciples or I'm following him. What he would say is, I sit at that rabbi's feet. So I think when those women are described as sitting at Jesus' feet, it means at least they were acting like disciples. They're with him everywhere, which is really unusual. They're in a situation, you know, Jesus, Mary and Martha are there. Mary is sitting at Jesus' feet. Martha says, tell my sister to come and to do her job too. And Jesus says, she's sitting at my feet, she's picked the better thing. Now, did he mean she's listening to my lecture, or did it mean she's chosen to follow me? I think it's likely that that phrase, to sit at the rabbi's feet there, reflects the fact those women were at least informally disciples. Now your question, why don't we talk about that? I think, personally, it isn't so much because, at least in contemporary time, that we don't think women should be disciples. I think it's more likely we're just not familiar with the jargon that's used to describe what a disciple is. So I think there were 7 women if they were not formally disciples, are informally disciples. And that's unusual. Only Hillel, of all the great rabbis, only Hillel had women that sat at his feet. So it would make Jesus one of two. Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. There's four Marys. Mary Magdalene, and the other Mary, she's called. Joanna, Chutzah's wife. You know who Chutzah is? He's the minister of finance of Herod's kingdom. It says the manager of Herod's household, but household is the king's kingdom. Probably. Herod was king of the Jews, so he's probably a Jew. This guy was about as pagan a king as who'd ever lived, and so he's, in a sense, in the cabinet. So Jesus, and it says Joanna and Susanna were supporting Jesus' ministry out of their own pocket. So Jesus' ministry is in part being supported by Herod. Right. You know, I think in Galilee, it's a bit of a stretch to say it that way. I don't think in Galilee anybody owned anything. I think it was all totally communal. That's part of what makes the prodigal son such a bizarre parable, because for the son to say, give me my share, is totally Greek. The kid has sold out on the biblical worldview by asking. Because to say my share, since when do we divide stuff into shares? It's all ours. So he's already sold out. But I think a woman, with her husband's permission, in a Jewish setting, would have been able to use household income to support a great rabbi. I mean, great rabbis, it's an enormous thing in a Jewish world for a great rabbi to come to town. And people are willing to spend large sums of their own money to make it happen. Now, Joanna comes from a very secular setting. Her husband, who Chutzah probably was Jewish, although Chutzah is a Greek name, he is without question a Hellenist. He's a Greek in worldview. So in that world, women had very much their own personal wealth. So it may be that Joanna was a wealthy woman in her own right, whereas Susanna, Mary, it's less likely because they were Jewish. Do you know how Herod made his money? Herod made his money from Viagra. He had invented... Well, that's not true either. In the Old Testament, there's something called the Balm of Gilead. The Balm of Gilead is made from the extract of the camphora tree. In the New Testament, it was called balsam. And about the time of Herod the Great, the one who killed the babies in Bethlehem, the father of the Herod we're talking about, a rumor spread, a fad spread throughout the Roman world, that balsam was an aphrodisiac. Pliny wrote, "One drop of balsam behind a man's ear will drive a woman wild with lust at 100 paces." So it got to the point where a vial of that stuff was worth the equivalent of $100,000 American dollars. And Herod became the wealthiest man on the face of the earth, marketing a substance which was wholly for sexual enhancement. Not medicinal even. It was purely about Las Vegas. And what's ironic is they found some in a vial. In fact, they found two bodies who had both been beheaded in a cave near Jericho. This was in 1996, I think, 6 or 7. And when they took those bodies out of the cave, they found beneath them, as they were digging in the dust of this cave, that those men apparently had excavated a little hole in the cave, and in it they had hidden their possessions, including a flask of balsam. So we know what was in it. It was totally a fraud. There is nothing in it that has any properties whatsoever that do anything for anyone's sexuality. So Herod was marketing this thing completely fraudulently and getting rich. And what's so ironic is that's probably where Joanna is getting her money from. So you talk about God having a sense of humor. It's one of those amazing things.